The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained, now with a new and improved website. The first month of your membership is 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Wink. Wink is offering our audience members who are 21 and over a free bottle of wine when you become a new member of Wink. So, to get yours, go to trywink.com/Jim. That's trywinc.com/Jim. Get yours. You'll love it. And please drink responsibly. Thanks, Wink.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you today. And we have a fine lineup of guests today. We're going to start with Ian Punnett. He actually has a true crime book out. Now, Ian, as you know, was the weekend host of Coast to Coast AM for many years. And we typically don't do true crime on this show. But in this case, for Ian, we made an exception. And I think you're really going to enjoy hearing from Ian again and hearing about this great new book, A Black Night for the Bluegrass Bell. Part two, we've got Tim Beckley and friends. They're going to talk about all matters of things cryptid. I think you'll enjoy that. But before we get to the program, and usually we don't hesitate, but I have a special announcement, and I think you're going to like it. For many years, I have thought about doing a cruise where I would go out with listeners and we'd have fun and talk paranormal and all that stuff. And it just never came together. And then out of the blue, a couple of weeks ago, I was approached by Mike Migliori. He has advertised some of his cruises on the programs before. He is the head cook and bottle washer over at Holiday Maker Travel. And he said, "I'm thinking about this cruise. Would you like to be a part of it?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I'm so excited. It's going to be November of 2017. It's going to be to the Caribbean on the Princess Line. So, you know, top-notch everything. But I'm even more excited about the people who are going to join me. And let me give you the lineup here. First of all, my good friend and buddy, Micah Hanks, is going to be joining me, podcaster and author and musician and just a great guy. I mean, if you've not met Micah in person, wow, you're in for a treat. And then last but not least, and get this, this is a big, big name. Amy Bruni of Kindred Spirits and Ghost Hunters fame is going to be joining us as well. So we're all going to get to cruise together, but it's not only going to be just, hey, we get to shake hands and things. We're going to have private, exclusive onboard lectures, presentations, and panels, and shore excursions. And it's all included. It's going to be great. And I think that you're going to love it. So if you want to check this out, you're going to want to go to mysteriescruise.com. That's MYSTERIES cruise.com. And right now there's a great special going on. I believe this is going for a week. So you're going to want to, I'm recording this on December 13th. You're going to want to jump on this. Now, usually the deposit is $250 per person, but during this special, it's only $50 per person in terms of a deposit. Then if you book during this week, you get an onboard coupon booklet. And it's over $300 in savings for onboard services like pictures and spa treatments and things of that like. Plus, if you book in the month of December and use the promo code JHDEC, then you'll get a free autographed copy of my Campfire 5 book. I hope you'll join us. It is going to be so cool going down to the Caribbean and cruising with our paranormal peeps, both Amy and Micah and you. I hope you can join us. Mysteriescruise.com. That's mysteriescruise.com. I'll see you there. And now we're going to sail into the next episode of the Paranormal Podcast. And here's Ian. Well, it is a red letter day here. We have a very distinguished guest, and we're going to talk about, well, I guess it's not paranormal per se, but the person we're going to talk to has a connection to the paranormal. There's even kind of a ghost story in this book, but I'm talking about
kind of a ghost story.
Yeah, well, it is a ghost story. You probably recognize that voice. That's Ian Punnett. He is one of the former hosts of The Great Mothership Coast to Coast AM, and he's currently an instructor of multimedia journalism at Ohio Northern University, just down the highway a couple of hours from me. And he has a new book out. It's called A Black Night for the Bluegrass Belle, The Murder of Verna Gar Taylor, and The Kentucky Honor Code Killing That Gave Her Justice. And Ian Punnett is with us. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. If I'm from the mothership, I'm really more like one of those anonymous crewmen who always are dead in the first 10 minutes of every Star Trek episode.
You're wearing the right shirt.
I make no claim beyond that.
No. I've told Ian this before, and I've stated it when he's been on the program before. He's a great role model, fantastic host, and was always one of my favorites. I always singled out the Ian Punnett shows to listen to.
Good. Well, thank you for that. Appreciate that.
And I love this book. Now, A Black Night for the Bluegrass Belle. Now, some might think, well, Ian has decided to become an author, so he's just picked a random true crime case to embark on. But this case that dates back to the 1930s has an extremely personal connection for you, doesn't
it? Yep. Well, I mean, it's this is a story that I heard really as a bedtime story almost for many years off and on. My mother would tell me the story of my grandmother's first cousin, a woman named Verna Gar. Her last name was Taylor, but we always just called her Verna Gar. That was her maiden name. And Verna was a dedicated mother. She was a widow too early. She was a successful woman ahead of her time. She inherited a business from her husband that she not only kept going, but she improved, and she learned everything she needed to know about the laundry and dry cleaning business. She had she expanded their contracts with institutions like the Kentucky Military Institute, so that she had a steady income. And in 1936, in the height of the Depression, she owned her own house. She owned her own car. She owned her own business. She even had a phone in her home, which was almost unheard of in those days for most people, and except for the very rich. And she was a woman who loved fashion, life. She dressed well, and she had two teenage daughters, one of whom was on the cusp of getting married, and she had just started to date a guy who had proposed marriage to her, a fairly powerful man, a guy who had a big personality and kind of swept her up a little bit. But in the end, she declined his invitation to marriage on the very night that he says she committed spontaneous suicide.
Well, I've got to tell you, this book clocks in at over 300 pages, and I just finished reading it. And I must say, quite striking. What a lot of detail. And before we get into the case, I've got to ask you a little bit about the investigative work that went behind this. I mean, we're talking the mid-1930s here. How in the world did you get this level of detail about this case? Because it seemed like you, almost like you were talking to people who may have been there. I mean, I'm sure the family connection has a lot to do with it, but how did you accomplish this decades later?
Well, I two things. I did talk to people who were there in the case of my mother, who also preserved stories from her mom and other relatives, which I used liberally throughout the story. But also, I lucked out. I just plain old lucked out. They had recovered the transcripts from two trials, plus all of the legal files pertaining to those cases in the boxes of one of the attorneys that represented the man that murdered my kin. And they had just turned them over. I'd already started writing the book. I'd already started to write the book using press clippings and true crime magazine articles. True crime magazines became very popular in the 1930s, and they loved this story, and they wrote about it often. And so I had all of those accounts. And then I got a call from a cousin who said, I just saw it in the paper this morning, the John Marshall Berry papers have been turned over to Filson Historical Society, and they're open to the public. And I was on a plane that night from Phoenix to Louisville to look at them, and they changed everything.
Yeah, that, I mean, really, the level of detail here. So, Verna, tell us a little bit about, I mean, you told us about her background as a businesswoman, and she was a widow far too soon and so forth. I mean, what kind of person was she in your view?
Well, Verna was probably, I mean, it's interesting. What I did is I turned to several old Coast to Coast guests for help. One of whom was a forensic psychologist, Catherine Lamson, Ramsland, and she had she agreed to do a suicidology of Verna. As the defense had claimed Verna had committed suicide, she agreed to look at her life, look at her story, look at the details from the case, and make draw up the likelihood scenarios for suicide. And then she just wrote, I sent her the material. She wrote back almost immediately and said, this is impossible. You can't do a suicidology of somebody who didn't commit suicide. There's no way she committed suicide. There's no way to do a suicidology. She doesn't check any of the boxes. This was murder.
Yeah. Well, the thing that was interesting in the book to me was the day that she was murdered, I believe, or committed suicide, or that earlier, when she was with Denhart, who I want to talk about as well. But she went to a bank and inquired about getting an interest-bearing account that would make her more money. Now, that's one of the first things they look at for suicide.
Sure.
Has somebody been giving things away, saying I might not
be here? Or making plans.
Exactly. You don't make plans to get more interest if you're going to kill yourself.
So, and again, we'll get into the antagonist in this in a few minutes, but to back, it all circles back to your question about what kind of woman was she. She was a very decent, modest Methodist woman, and she was very concerned about appearances in the Southern tradition, and there was no way that she would do the things which she were doing the day before she was killed if she had been planning on suicide. That is, she had contracted with a man to come and fix a chimney who was supposed to be there in the morning. She had already started to make, you know, that she was in a negotiation and sort of a protracted negotiation. Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know how to do this to turn that off when we're talking on Skype.
Not a problem. Don't worry about it.
So, so it was a very I fear my wife's going to call again because she's persistent. I'll try and send a message to her. So the point was is that she had really no reason to commit suicide, and there was no signs of her committing. So she was planning on business the next day. She was planning on business in the years ahead. And probably the biggest fight that she was having with Denhart was that she was that he wanted to take control of her business. And she didn't want him to get anywhere near it. She was perfectly happy running her own business, and she felt perfectly competent. So that's just part of it. The other part of it being, too, is that the family knew that night that she was going to break up with him. The family knew it because even my grandfather had been involved. He had been a former police detective with the Louisville Police Department, and he had been consulted, and he looked into Denhart, and he came back and said, tell her to get away from this guy. He's a foul ball.
Foul ball, yeah. Now, let's talk about Denhart. That's Brigadier General Henry Denhart. So he did have some, I guess, fame. He had been the lieutenant governor, I guess, of the state.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was a guy with some stature. I mean, how did she get connected with him, and what kind of guy was he? Apparently not a very nice one.
Well, he had both fame and infamy. He was an egotistical man. He was somebody who had to be the – he was very alpha. He had to be the top of everything. And so he rose in ranks up through the military. He was also a lawyer who then became a judge, who then got into politics and became the lieutenant governor. When he was serving a previous governor, he also used the Kentucky National Guard – abused probably the privileges of the Kentucky National Guard to serve some political interest by the governor that that he was serving under by bringing the Kentucky National Guard into disputed areas. One was a labor dispute. The other was a political dispute where he stole the ballot boxes down in bloody Harlan County. I mean, he was a guy who's at the center of controversy. He's a guy who'd already been shot once. because of a political squabble. He had already gotten a bullet in the shoulder once, running up the street trying to get away from a guy chasing him with a gun. And so he was a big name, and he was a controversial figure, and some people thought he was always on the wrong, and that, you know, that this was a guy who was always about getting involved in things he shouldn't get involved with. And then there were some people who thought, oh, he's just they talk about him so badly. He was a war hero. That'll leave him alone. You know, it was all of that sort of stuff. But really, by the time he started dating Verna, whom he had met when he had retired from politics and then moved to just outside of LaGrange, Kentucky, where Verna lived, when that started, he was considered by many to be the most hated man in Kentucky for the accumulative years of all of that time that he had gotten involved in things which he probably shouldn't have done. So, you know, he'd also been everywhere. He'd been everywhere that she never had been. He'd been to Paris. He'd been to London. He knew all these famous people. She was a little wooed. I think she was a little smitten. And then the more she got to know him, the more she realized the people who say that he was involved in things he shouldn't have been were right. And he was just one of those personalities that just couldn't stop getting into fights and causing trouble. And that's what he did with her too. I mean, eventually she had to throw him out of her house at one point because he couldn't stop from starting arguments. And he was also a bit of a drinker.
Yeah, it just seemed like bad news. I guess even when he was a child, he was reported to be both a bully in some cases and a coward in others.
Right. So like a lot of bullies, they knew when to pick their fights, right? I mean, the bullies don't pick on people more powerful than them. They don't fight up. Bullies always fight down. And that's the story of Denhart's life.
Now, in terms of the night in question, now, this is kind of first of all, it appears from my reading that she was basically kept against her will for the better part of 12 hours. And then there was a series of car problems. And then spontaneously, by Denhart's account, she spontaneously decided to commit suicide with a gun that was in his car, .45 service revolver. That doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, to be honest.
No, it doesn't, and it never did. And the only reason why he was able to get a hung jury for the first trial was because he hired a dream team of the best legal minds in Kentucky, and they were able to obfuscate the state's evidence, and to a large degree, the state played right into their hands by attempting to make a CSI case against the general. This new crime science of the 1930s was still kind of in its toddling phases. It had problems. It was difficult to for an unsophisticated jury. It was a hard sell, and the prosecution didn't sell it well. So he was able to get off on that. But if you anytime you look at the case from any other objective view, you come away going, "What? This was a woman who decided to commit suicide by shooting herself through the left side with her right arm. That's the only way this was possible, because when they found her body, she was clutching her gloves in her left hand, and there was no blood on the scene. So they knew the body had been moved. They found a blood splotch up the road. There's no way she could have shot herself through the heart there and then made it all the way down to the place where her body was found. I mean, nothing adds up. Not a thing adds up. But Denhart was wily, and he knew how to lie, and he got on the witness stand, and he told one of his many versions of what happened that night. He was always changing the story to fit the crowd. Whatever it would take to convince them, that's the way the story would drift.
Do you think it was a case of kind of early jury nullification in the sense that there were two things? One, he was, quote, a military hero. And two, it was kind of a case of sexism. I mean, I think it was hinted at that maybe she had a questionable relationship with one of her employees.
Well, they just made up anything. I mean, that was just right. The point. I mean, he just – he it wasn't Well, first of all, since the acquittal was 7-5 in Dinhart's favor, and anybody who buys the book, I think some of the most enjoyable aspects of the book are reading from the trial transcripts. Yes. It's so colorful, and the jury is clearly distraught. I mean, they many of the people on the jury are 100% convinced of his guilt. That's not nullification in that sense. If it had come back 12-0 or something like that, then you might say, well, gosh, it certainly was a case later on of jury nullification.
Yeah. We'll get
but
to that.
We'll get to that. But in this case, no, he had done enough to muddy the waters. And if what they're asked to do is to know beyond a reasonable doubt, it's not shadow of a doubt, it's a reasonable doubt. And the defense was able to give them some reason to doubt the state's case, and the case by the state tripped over a couple of scientific points. So I actually don't blame the jury for coming back hung. I think had the case been prosecuted differently, or if it had been done in Louisville, where people perhaps with a higher level of education might have seen through some of what the defense was offering, one of which was this sort of steady insinuation that Verna had a lover, and maybe it was the lover who did it. Well, he wasn't on the road. She didn't have a lover. The person they're talking about was a person half her age who was the driver of the truck. And the only reason that he got roped into this was because they needed to offer, you know, some plausible other theory to the jury. So they just made one up. And unfortunately, that story has stuck. And it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, was to disprove once and for all. I saw a professor from an established university in Kentucky write a piece not 5-10 years ago in which he said that the jury couldn't make up their mind because of Verna's lover. She was a femme fatale. Like, she had done this to herself. She had brought all this intrigue on. And it was just so unfair to say that this thing that had been made up by the defense has somehow taken on has been riveted and has been forged somehow in the kiln of history. And now it's become established as some sort of fact. It never was then. Nobody ever believed it. The family knew it was false. Everybody knew it was wrong, and the only person who kept offering that story was Dinhart. There's no other evidence, no other proof, no other testimony that anything like that was ever true.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. Our guest is Mr. Ian Punnett. He is the author of the new book, A Black Knight for the Bluegrass Bell, and we'll be right back after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia. This time of the year, instead of season's greetings, I guess these days I should be saying streaming greetings, because almost everyone will find a new streaming device in their stocking, whether it's a Chromecast, an Apple TV, a Roku, or if you've got a really big stocking, a smart TV. Now, all of those platforms are fantastic, but the question, the important thing is, what do you watch? Now, of course, you have all those great movie channels everyone knows about. The names are household names. I won't repeat them here. But what if you want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained? Well, there is an answer, and that answer is Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. And not only is Gaia great on streaming devices, but Gaia has a brand new website that has taken everything they do to the next level. You can enjoy your own personalized homepage and always have great recommendations ready to stream. You watch their shows with upgraded lightning-fast streaming. You'll experience their simplified navigation for easy discovery, and you can bookmark your favorite moments and mind-blowing new ideas with Gaia's Community Hearts feature. So you can stream Gaia anywhere. All these great devices, the great website, on apps, on your devices, your phones, and your tablets. It's fantastic. Regardless of the platform, you explore life's biggest mysteries from specialists in these areas on Gaia's exclusive programs with hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and of course, George Norrie. It really is the way to go. I think that you will really enjoy Gaia, and it's a great time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. To mine the wisdom, be entertained, and enlightened, just go to gaia.com/Jim. That is GAIA.com /Jim to sign up for your first month. It's only 99 cents. You probably have that rattling around in your couch cushions. Check it out. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Ian Punnett. The book is A Black Night for the Bluegrass Bell, a true crime story right from the annals of Ian's family. And fascinating it is. Now, we were talking about the General Denhart. There's some reason to believe that he may have actually had a mental condition. Is that true?
Oh, I think that's certainly what Catherine Ramsland was insinuating. And then I also turned to another former Coast to Coast guest and a guy who I'd been friendly with for many years, who is an expert on sociopathic, narcissistic personalities. And it's Dr. Les Carter, and he's written many books about them and how to avoid them, how to identify when somebody has one, and then the dangers of being in relationship with one. So Denhart, he said, is a classic narcissist sociopath. The difference between your garden variety narcissist, somebody who just thinks the whole world revolves around them, is they're just kind of egotistical, and they're very touchy. They tend to be very thin-skinned. And they're always thinking that something has done them wrong, and they're very focused on injustice, that they never get the respect they deserve, and they feel like they have the right to tell everybody everything. But the sociopathic part is the next level from a narcissist personality. Not all narcissists become sociopathic, but all sociopaths are in some form narcissistic, and that's when you feel like you have the right to act on that. And so there's very strong evidence that suggests that Denhart had already killed at least one other time. In this case, a woman who is known in Louisville ghost lore as the Lady in Blue. And she haunts the Seelbach Hotel, which is now owned by Hilton. It's the Seelbach Hilton in downtown Louisville. It's a wonderful hotel, by the way. And there's the stories of the haunting of the Lady in Blue go back to a night when Denhart was in the hotel and a prostitute was murdered. She was prostitute, you know, slash party girl. I mean, she was a prostitute for all intents and purposes, but there was a different type of, she was kind of like maybe what we call a call girl today. So she went to hotels and she didn't work the streets or anything like that, but she was known to a certain clientele as being always available for a party. And she went down an elevator shaft to her death. It was a painful death. She lingered for quite a while on the top of the elevator that was down at the bottom of the shaft before she died. Denhart was spotted there, and in fact, even before his death, they had begun the first steps of prosecution for him and his responsibility of that, and that was before he died. So I think there were two cases that are linked to him, and they all both say the same thing: is women he didn't feel had the right to tell him no, or he had the right to decide which woman in his life lived or died, or that he felt like he had the right to tell anybody who lived and died. After all, he was a general. And he wasn't a popular general, too. He was known as, you know, somebody who over-disciplined his men. They called him the Iron General, but it wasn't a compliment.
And actually, the thing that seems to have set him off was a conversation on this the day of the event, or earlier in the day before the event, where she wanted to give him back an expensive ring he had purchased for her. And that kind of set him off, apparently.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the word purchase. I'd never.
Interesting.
Right? I mean, we're dealing with narcissist sociopaths. Do we really know how he got that ring? It's weird because he does give her a very expensive ring. But there's no – I mean, by today's dollar, it would be an engagement ring worth about $20,000, which, of course, was a ton of money back then. And he gave it to her, but I don't know, poker game? Somewhere along the line, pulled off a dead body, found on a battlefield. I don't know. There's just something about this. It just doesn't add up as something that he went out and purchased for her, especially because he turned out to be, and I very well document this, just an absolute cheat in every other regard. Cheated his lawyers, cheated everybody.
Yeah.
He never paid his bills. So it seems out of character for him to spend that much money on a an engagement ring.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah, I kind of jumped to that assumption, but it's
no, I did too. I mean, I was like, I never said purchased, but you know, even after the book came out, I kept thinking that just does not add up to me.
Right? Yeah, yeah. How did he get that one? And as you said, he pretty much worked to stiff his lawyers.
Oh yeah, I mean that was through, and that's the funny part about getting all of these papers from the law offices all these years later, 80 years later, here he is, they writing him, begging him to pay his bills. It's the Depression. They've got bills. And in fact, not only was he not paying them, he was somehow wheedling money from them. So at one point, he owed them like $500 or something. I can't remember what the exact figure is, but it was money. And it was just to float him alone temporarily. I'm sure that it was what he told him at the time. And then he just never paid it back. So he's just that kind of a scoundrel. But in the case of the ring, she really did try to give it back to him that night. And in one of his many versions of what happened, one of his many recantations of the dialogue that happened between them, she offered it back to him and he declined. And in one version, he's very magnanimous about it. He goes, I just want you to keep it for the rest of your life, just knowing how much I loved you or whatever. And then in others, she says, I don't deserve this. You're the greatest man. You're greater than God. I think at one point he says in one of his versions, it's just preposterous that a Methodist woman would say something like that, especially unless she was just trying to placate him, unless she already saw the anger burning behind his eyes. But you're right. I think that's what starts to trip him off is she says no, she tries to give back the ring, and he will not take no for an answer.
Yeah, it's something else. But so the first trial ends in a hung jury. There's going to be a second trial, and then the Gar brothers, Velma's brothers, step in, and they mete out, I guess you would call it, some Southern justice. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to look at it, and it's interesting. I was raised very strongly with the belief that this was not a revenge killing, that this was an honor killing, which is a different thing. They were preparing to save Verna's honor. Denhardt's many versions of the story had become very blue. He had become very focused on telling these dirty stories about Verna. And part of it, I think, was just to tweak the nose of the Gar family for their persistence in seeing him prosecuted, but also because I'm sure he thought in his own mind it elevated him, that here he was with a woman of such low repute. So he had written some of these stories, appeared in his files in the law office. It wasn't what he testified to in court. So if in the first case he was to be believed after having sworn to the oath in the first trial, she was a wonderful woman. And she was just confused, and she had troubles, and she took his gun, and much to his dismay, she killed herself. So that's the first version. But in other versions, he starts to tell in bars, and they start getting written down. And one of the most salacious versions of this appears in a true detective magazine, where they had a guy who told the whole story of what Denhardt was willing to say for a couple of drinks. And I will tell you the whole story, the whole secret story of what happened that night. And the drinks start flowing and Denhardt starts talking, and he paints Verna out to be just like the prostitute that he shoved down the elevator. And I think in his own mind, maybe that was a justification too, that somehow she wasn't what everybody thinks she was. And she was no one should miss her. That wasn't the case, and the family knew that that was a lie, and he had already said that this was the version, the final version, the final true version is what he was going to tell on the defense stand for his retrial, and the family was just not going to let him do that to Verna's honor. So they decided that he had to be stopped. He had to be prevented from being given the opportunity to perjure himself again. And that's just what they did in the streets outside of the Armstrong Hotel in Shelbyville, Kentucky.
when the Gars went on trial for this, and they succeeded in silencing him by, I think there were seven shots, but they didn't all hit, but I think there were seven shots. But they got rid of him quite expeditiously. There was another trial, and this one seemed to be an absolute sensation. And as we talked about earlier, jury nullification seemed to be a definite factor in this one.
And I think the two cases parallel them so interestingly. So I hope that people who are interested in buying the book will pay attention to that part, because I actually had so much fun writing it that the Gar trial becomes this weird mirror of the Denhart trial. I mean, just didn't look at what happened afterwards. So they shoot him on the street in front of the entire town, stand there and hand their guns over to the local police authorities when they show up and say, "We did it." So already they're doing something completely different than what Denhart had done, which is concoct all these stories and to deflect blame and to try to get away with it. They never did. They said, "We did it." Only two of the three brothers fired. The third brother, the younger, there's three men at this point, all of whom were all successful. They were all professional. None of these were, you know, I think some people think Kentucky feud when they hear a story like this, and they're imagining people in overalls and like the Darlins from the Andy Griffith Show or something. And these guys all had, they were, two of them were in business with each other, and they traveled all across North America in business, and they also owned farms, and those were successful. The older one had been a survivor of World War I. He was called Doc, and Doc was a veterinarian, and he suffered from shell shock. And he was the one who originally introduced Denhart to Verna. Being a fellow World War I veteran, he thought he had some sort of connection with Denhart, and then felt very much different later. But so Doc and Roy and Jack, the Gar boys, did it completely the opposite. They went to jail that night. They were stayed in jail for a while. They finally went on trial. And by the time they went on trial, they tried Roy first, for reasons we explained in the book. And the jury came back pretty quick in his favor. It was exactly what Denhart always wanted, was a full acquittal, which he never got. And instead, Roy got it, even though he said, "Yep, I shot him." And he ends up getting, you know, a unanimous jury that said that they had taken a vote and they had discovered they were all 12 in agreement after the first 5 minutes of being in the jury chambers, but decided to wait an extra hour to make it look like they were thinking it over before they came out. And so Roy walks, and when they decided they couldn't get Roy, they didn't even go after the other two brothers. But it's the detail, it's the testimony, it's the funny way in which the defense really kind of mocked the Denhart trial in the second trial that has to be read to be believed.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Certainly recommend it for any true crime fan. Now, I want to ask you this. This is a question, I guess, is Ian the family member, maybe not Ian the radio host and the author. Now, I got the sense in the book. Now, intellectually, I'm guessing you're probably not for vigilante justice, but as Ian, who heard these stories as a little boy, I mean, was part of you saying, "Good on the Gar brothers. I'm glad they did it."
Well, part of yes, and I will say that this is a conversation my wife and I have all the time, because she's a little bit more uncommitted on the issue of whether or not what they did was good. So I will say I think what the Gar boys did was they prevented Denhart from killing their sister a second time, this time killing her spirit, killing her good memory, killing her good name from the witness stand. And I think that that's not a justifiable homicide. I think what they did afterwards, though, was exactly what you should do, is they were willing to go to the electric chair if it meant protecting their sister's honor. And I think that's a very different case. So they didn't kill Denhart and then stand up and say, we should not be held responsible for this. They went to trial. They stayed in jail. They did all the things they were supposed to do. And the public overwhelmingly supported their exoneration. So, yes, that I don't even know if I call that vigilante justice, because if they'd really wanted vigilante justice, there was 24 times before then that they could have killed him. But it was only when they became convinced that he, as he'd been telling in every bar around Kentucky, even his own attorneys were sending letters to each other, right, Jim? I mean, you saw the where they were right. saying, tell right. him to shut up.
Yeah.
Tell him he's going to ruin every – tell their – you know, they were telling their own client to just shut up, but he wouldn't listen to anybody. And he wasn't acting honorably. And I think in some ways you could argue that he would have very likely killed again. And he hadn't learned his lesson yet. So did they end up saving another life somewhere? We can only wonder. It's not something I would teach my kids to do, but I think it's understandable in the scope of history.
Some people would say, Ian, this is a long time ago. This is in the 1930s. Why? And I'm not saying this personally, but I can hear people saying, why do you care so much? Why? It's over. It's long gone. Why do you care so much?
Funny, but another book came out once about this, and they took a much more neutral position on whether or not Verna shot herself. And it's like, you don't – that's not – you know, there's not – there is no – I can't this had to be said once and definitively and for all of what happened that night. We didn't even talk about how Denhart, according to the medical examiners, had sexually assaulted Verna. I mean, it would be like writing a book. It would be like being a member of Nicole Brown Simpson's family and having somebody write a book sometime later about how Nicole Brown Simpson chopped off her own head, you know, and just say, yeah, it's a possibility. And giving that the kind of some ridiculous notion that the defense made up in the O.J. Simpson trial about how it had been South American drug lords that had come up.
Yeah, I really did think about – I almost asked you about it. I thought about the parallels of the cases.
Oh, my God. Well, you know that O.J. Simpson said the exact same thing, word for word, when the police came to pick him up. He said, you know, I couldn't have killed her. I loved her too much.
Right.
That is exactly what Denhart said. Now, how weird is that? The two narcissist Strange. Sociopaths would say that, have that same idea. They offer that like that makes a kind of sense. You, by loving somebody too much, you can't murder them. So if he actually, you know, if you don't love somebody too much, then you can kill them. None of that makes sense. You just don't kill people. It's not a matter of how much you love them or don't love them.
The other odd thing that this one really struck me too was when the general, upon the shots being heard, starts talking about Verna in the past tense before she's even been discovered.
Immediately. And the first thing he says when they come up to her after he said, you know, did you hear those shots? She was the finest woman I ever knew.
I
love her so much. Okay. What? How do you, are you not, if that's your fiance and you suspect the worst, are you not running up and down the street screaming, Verna, Verna, trying to find her?
Yep.
You just stand up immediately and go, well, that one's over. I guess we're done here. All right, let's move on. And that's pretty much his attitude. And that's part of what, of course, then later on, even though there are five witnesses around that hear him say that and testify to that under oath, he says, I never said that. And the only reason I repeated it was because they kept prompting me. So he never said it. But the only reason he repeated it was because they kept prompting me. It's just that kind of ridiculous stuff. You just can't even believe it's in the court record.
Have you gotten any pushback from the Denhart defender side?
No. I don't think there's any left.
Well, I mean, I don't see, based on the facts you present, I don't see how anybody could defend him.
No. I agree.
It seems patently obvious. And another thing that's patently obvious is if somebody enjoys true crime and really wants to get kind of a feel for the time, the 1930s, a very different time than in which we live today, I highly recommend that they check out A Black Night for the Bluegrass Bell. And Ian Punnett, where would they find this fine book?
Well, first of all, I forgot to answer your question, too. So the other reason I wrote it is because Ann Rule told me to.
Yes, you mention in the book how how what a great relationship you had with Ann Rule, of course, the queen of true crime, passed not that long ago, and she's a major influence.
She told me there's no story too old. That if the story is good, it needs to be told. Don't worry about the age. So that was the other reason where, to answer your question about how old the story is, it's just that good. And the details in it just can't be missed. The book is available. I think Amazon gets them and sells out, BarnesandNoble.com had them. They are available in any Barnes & Noble location in Kentucky, I am told. I think the fastest way to get them, if you'd like to order a copy of Black Knight for the Bluegrass Bell and make sure that you have it for, say, Christmas or holiday gift giving, it is through a publisher itself, acclaimpress.com. If you go to the website, you can order it, I think, before – I forget what the cutoff is, the 13th or the 15th. If you order before then, you can get it by USPS. It should be there in time for Christmas, or you can have it overnighted for an extra amount. But you can get the book. It's a great book, especially for somebody maybe who loves true crime or people who love unusual history, because I put a lot of time and effort into capturing the historical detail of the period. And it's available at acclaimpress.com, amongst others. So thank you.
We get a lot of books over here, and when somebody puts their heart and soul into it, you can tell it, and you can tell it with A Black Knight for the Bluegrass Bell. Ian, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here, and people, your fans would love it just for the revenge of the ghost that comes to at the end of that story. So we revisit the ghost story at the end, and I think one of these days I'm going to have to get her a headstone. It's on my list of things to do soon, to say thank you to the universe for all that has happened here. Is the woman in the lady in blue, the ghost in the Seelbach Hotel, deserves a headstone. So I'll let you know when I get around to do that, and we'll have a service.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
It is always an honor to have Ian Punnett on the show. Really, in my view, one of the great radio talk hosts out there, and an honor. So thank you again, sir. And next, we're going to have Tim Beckley and friends. We're going to talk about all matter of things cryptid, spooky stuff, right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Wink. Wink is offering our listeners who are 21 and over a free bottle of wine when you become a new member of Wink, and I think that you're going to love it. So, what is Wink? Well, Wink is a wine service that you subscribe to, and then you get a shipment of wine every month, and it is so, so cool. Now, you remember, for the longest time, I talked about Club W. Well, Club W is now Wink, and that's spelled W-I-N-C. But there's the same great set up the same great service. I love it because what they're doing is they're taking all the snobbery out of wine purchasing and being a fan of wine. And for people like me who aren't into that whole thing and didn't really know a lot about wine, they're taking all that away and making it very approachable and very easy. Now, I'm going to give you a special URL you can go to and take advantage of this, where basically once you become a member and have your first order of 4 bottles of wine, you will get 1 bottle free. And that's, of course, for people who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. It is a great deal. Now, first of all, to get started, it's very accessible, not intimidating at all. You don't have to know thing one about wine. You just go over to trywink.com/Jim. That's trywink.com/Jim. Sign up. Take their 20-second palate profile quiz, and they just ask you a few questions about things that you like to eat and drink. And based on your tastes, they'll say, hey, maybe you'll like this wine, or maybe you'll like that wine. And of course, you can deviate from that at any time, but it really is a great way to get into wine without knowing a lot about wine. And it's kind of fun because over the last couple of years, I feel like I've become more educated by wine because they also have a bunch of great information and videos. So next time you're at a party, you can seem like you're the one that knows so much about wine. Now, again, the price point for most of their wines is $13. So by signing up with Wink at the special URL, you're getting your first bottle for free. So all you have to do is go over to trywink.com/Jim. TRYWINC.com/Jim. I think you'll love it. I love it. It's great for this time of the year, entertaining, the holidays, the new year. Jump on it quick. TryWink.com/Jim. Thanks, Wink. And here's part two of this week's Paranormal Podcast. Enjoy. The book is, and I want to make sure I get this right, Cryptid Creatures from Dark Domains, Dogmen, Devil Hounds, Phantom Canines, and Real Werewolves. And we have a hat trick of great guests, Timothy Green Beckley. And with two of the people who authored this book, and it's a cornucopia of many people, many great authors. But the two people joining us tonight are Claudia Cunningham and Michelle Lowe. And we're so glad to have them with us. Now, Tim, he's kind of a bon vivant of the paranormal. I didn't know how to introduce him, and I thought, what am I going to say? And the good news is I was reading on Amazon in his bio where he says, even his own girlfriend doesn't know what he does for a living. So I thought, okay, I don't feel so badly now. But basically, well, to say he's prolific. Yeah. He's prolific in the world of Fortiana and the paranormal. Is that fair enough?
Well, that's about the best description I've had. If you read the bio, you could go on for about 15 or 20 minutes with that. But if people don't know who I am by now, then they can go and find it, you know, anywhere on the internet. You know, because I've been doing this, researching the unknown and experiencing the unexplained for 50 years. I don't know. It goes back, I guess, to the house I lived in was haunted. You know, we had poltergeist phenomena. And then I had my first of three UFO sightings when I was 10 years old. And, you know, I wrote a letter to the local newspaper asking people to, like, report their sightings to me. And I was inundated with mail from the local community there in New Jersey, people that had odd experiences. And then as I got further and further and further down the rabbit hole, I became interested. You know, I met other people that were involved in this, like the late Ivan T. Sanderson, who mm-hmm. actually was probably the first to to hype or promote the existence of the Abominable Snowman. I remember he had a little paperback book that ran about 400 or 500 pages, and it was mainly about the sightings of the Abominable Snowman in the Himalayas. And then I met I was up at his place. He used to have a little organization up in Blairstown, New Jersey, and people would, you know, go up there probably unannounced for the most part on the weekends, and he didn't seem to care, and there was always somebody unusual there. And I remember meeting a gentleman who had a plaster of Paris cast of what he purported to be this very tall, hairy, smelly, heavyweight being of some type that was stalking the woods. I think it was in Washington State, because that seemed to be where the majority of sightings of these cryptoids were. But little by little by little, Jim, they spread out all over the country. And then we found out that actually this has been going on for hundreds of years. One of my contacts and associates over the years has been Brad Steiger. Oh, and he,
fantastic.
Well, he knew a number of the American shamans who I met later on. And they told about these creatures, and some of them actually in connection with UFOs. In fact, that has increased. There are some people who believe that these cryptoids are flesh and blood, you know, physical beings.
Sure.
And then there are more of us who tend toward accepting the fact that they may come here from some other dimension or
right.
some other reality.
Travels, yeah.
Yeah. And that would explain their ability to vanish almost, we could say, into thin air.
Yeah, that's why we don't find bodies, right?
Don't find bodies. And the even the evidence is a little bit shaky or shorty. I mean, the hair often turns out to be the hair of a dog. I mean, I don't, you know, but there's no doubt that people are observing and witnessing, you know, these creatures. Now, I was trying to do some research on this last night. I remember I was writing for the tabloids. That's how I made my living for a good many years, and I was kind of their UFO writer, you know, their stringer, freelancer, and I always managed to come up with some fairly good information, and legitimate. I mean, I wasn't sitting there making up the stuff for the Weekly World News or whatever. In fact, most people don't realize this, but the tabloids like the Inquirer, they often call the people that you interviewed. They wanted to hear tape recordings of, you know, what was said. I mean, they were pretty much on the level. Sure, once in a while something would slip through.
Well, I think there was a difference. The Inquirer was, I think, I mean, it's got a bad reputation, but I think it was a cut above a lot of the other tabloids. I mean,
the best was one out of Chicago called the Tattler.
Oh, never heard of that one. Wow.
Well, very, very poorly named, but it was named after a paper that had been out for, I don't know, you know, like 2.5 centuries in England or something. That's where it got its name.
Gotcha.
And they had, it was a, you know, pretty poorly printed newsprint, but it came out every week, and it had probably the best reporting of any of the newspapers. And then a lot of when the Tattler folded, a lot of the guys went down to Florida and got a job with the Inquirer, and they bought out the Globe, and then they had their silly season with the Weekly World News. But little by little, we found out that there was a definite connection. So I had received a letter, I forget which, this was quite a number of years ago, and I called a gentleman on the phone. I can't remember all the details, but I believed he lived in Wisconsin. His name was last name was Bosley, and he reported seeing this transparent globe on the highway in front of him at night. His headlights shone off of it, and he said that inside the globe he could actually see what appeared to be a large hairy creature behind the controls. It wasn't a large ship. It just seemed to be, you know, like a one-seater or something like that. And he did a drawing, you know, a sketch for me of this being that he saw. And I recognized it right away as, you know, a Bigfoot. And then over the years, we've heard other reports and all connecting the UFO phenomena and these unidentified objects. And so that's kind of my conclusion, is that they are a paranormal in nature. Maybe some of them are physical, but there just seems to be a lapse in evidence to some degree, if you want to say that they are physical, you know, flesh and blood beasts that wander, you know, Washington State and Oregon and California, because they've been seen all over. In fact, I remember talking to two teenagers who were on a golf course in Staten Island, and they claimed that they saw one of these giant hairy beings kind of limbering across the, you know, in a wooded area not too far away from where they were. So strange indeed it is, our friends, these crazy cryptoid creatures from dark domains.
Well, it is interesting, and we have two other great guests on the line to talk about their particular sections, and I'm fascinated by their section. So the idea here, I guess, was to get some of the best thinkers in this area. Now, we've interviewed a number of the people that actually are in this. I mean, we're talking Brad Steiger, who's been on the shows numerous times.
Oh, yes.
Every time I talk to him, I feel like I'm not worthy.
Well, and, you know, I met Brad when he had just written his first book, on UFOs, which I believe has just recently been reprinted by MUFON. It was called Strangers from the Skies. Mm-hmm. And it was a little paperback. In those days, they went for, what, 35 cents or something like that. Today, they'd be, you know, $7.95 if you could even find, really, a paperback as such, you know, these days. And he was very interested in the subject. I mean, there were a lot of writers in those days that was just grinding about because they could make a little bit of money, and paperbacks were big. I mean, I've edited like 30 different magazines over the years, and at one point you could put out a magazine on anything. Jim, I did a magazine called Moped Action. Can you imagine how much action there's on a moped?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I used to work for a company that put out magazines, and it was these business-to-business magazines. So it'd be books on roofing. I mean, it's amazing how many different magazines have been out through the years. Now,
Unfortunately, not anymore.
Not as much. Yeah, that's true. Everything's changed with digital. Now, and you've got Nick Redfern, who I kind of consider as the young Brad Steiger in terms of being so prolific indeed. And so forth, and Tim Schwartz, who's been on the program. So a lot of great people. So that was the idea to get to some of the best thinkers together with this book. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, see, I put – people say, well, how can you do so many books? Because I'm semi-retired, but I'm still doing 3 or 4 books a month. Well, see, having worked on all these magazines, I did a magazine called UFO Universe that actually was published for 11 years, and it was sold all over the world on newsstands. I learned how to do a publication relatively inexpensive. You don't have to go out and hire 40 people to do the job that 3 or 4 people can do. And I do it as most of them as a magazine format. Because to have one person sit down and write a book, it could take them 6 months or a year to do it. But if these writers that I know, I can go to them and say, here is a concept on something that I've been gathering information on. Give me your feedback on it. Because I've got 40 file drawers full of reports and letters and information that has come in to me over the course since 1962 or something like that.
Yeah, very cool. Now, I want to talk about, and I promise I'll get to both Michelle and Claudia. Now,
they have some great experiences. Yes.
Well, the one that I want to talk to Michelle about, and you know, we also do a true crime show because, like you, Timothy, I have a wide range of interest, and we do a true crime show. And one of the classic cases of American crime, horrible though it was, is that of Charles Manson and Helter Skelter and all of that. The Tate LoBianca murders. But how in the world would that involve a cryptid creature?
Well, you have to ask Michelle because this was her.
That's what I was doing. So, Michelle, tell us.
Well, we were going up to check out the house where the murders took place. And when we got there, it was pretty uneventful, actually, the first time when we went to the home. It was when we were leaving, and we probably got a half mile to a mile away where we just turned into one of the neighborhoods to just look around. And it was then that this giant black dog just appeared literally out of nowhere and just started charging the car. And my friend took off literally at full speed. I mean, as fast as he could in a neighborhood, probably 35, 40 miles an hour is what he got up to. And the dog was just running right beside the car barking. It was enormous, and it just kept following us until he finally got out of the neighborhood and got away, and we probably went 1 or 2 miles further and then pulled into another neighborhood just to kind of talk about what had just happened, you know, and about this dog. It was just unbelievable. And then out of nowhere, while we're sitting in this other neighborhood, the dog appears out of nowhere and starts chasing after us again. And again, we tore off out of the neighborhood and just went home at that point.
Yeah. I mean, that would be a frightening situation. Now, do you think there's a correlation between what happened there and the sighting? I mean, do you feel that there was something sinister about that place?
On reflection and just researching that whole area, you know, and it wasn't until years later that I really, really kind of thought about it, that I just felt that the dog was very supernatural. And it's very strange in that area. It's hard to explain, but it's just got its own kind of feeling to it in Benedict Canyon. And so it was just very strange. The whole situation, it just seems so surreal. And it was when we were, you know, up at the Cielo Drive home, you know, and just after leaving it. So reflecting back, I did feel that it was somehow related. And then when I started doing research and stuff, it was very interesting, you know, to see what it said about hellhounds, because I really felt that it was not a dog. It was too big to be a dog. It was very black and just literally ferocious.
Well, one thing about Manson, the thing that I've always been fascinated by Manson was, mm-hmm. is that he was kind of this wannabe musician, and somehow he captivated mm-hmm. both men and women. And, you know, he had basically a harem going on there, and he was able to.
He had that charisma.
Yeah. Well, that's the question I have. I mean, if you look at a picture of Charlie Manson circa whatever, 1968 or whatever it is. I mean, not exactly a movie idol. He wasn't a big burly guy. He wasn't physically imposing or muscular or anything that you would think would be like he wouldn't be a sex symbol, for example. But somehow he was able to lure these people in, men and women, and get them to do his bidding, whether it was for his own worldly pleasures or if it was to go out and kill people in his name. So the question is, other than just the charisma, do you think there might have been some kind of supernatural X factor at play?
That he had?
I'm asking you the question. Him, was there something there? You talk about these weird hellhounds and so forth.
I don't think that he really had. Yeah, I think it's more, the hellhounds were more related to the whole area as a whole in Benedict mm-hmm. Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably more ancient than that. I think that he possibly pulled negative energy around okay. him, absolutely. But I don't know how much paranormal may have been there. It's hard to say, but it does seem almost supernatural the way he had power over people to get them.
Right, right. And again, not being
Michelle, how big was this animal? How big was it?
Well, my friend was driving a Nova, and the dog's head came up over the door.
And Novas at that time, I mean, they were considered small cars, but they really weren't that small.
No, I would liken it to a mid-sized car. My dad had two wolves at separate times. One was a timber wolf, and I forgot what the other was called, but it would have been probably bigger than them, and they were huge.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
It was.
Now, do you agree with?
Yeah, very big, and the fur was like really black, pitch black, and very thick.
Now, do you agree with Tim? Tim was talking about how some of these cryptids, there's typically two explanations. One, they're just an animal we haven't discovered yet, and two, is there some kind of supernatural / interdimensional traveler, and that's why, as Tim said, we haven't found the evidence. Where do you kind of fall on that continuum? Do you think something like Dog Man could actually be an interdimensional shapeshifter of some type?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It seems like that would probably be the most likely scenario, too. Just by the way that they do have the ability to seem to disappear, you know, without a trace and seem to appear out of nowhere, too. I mean, with the dog, especially showing up the second time, you know, a couple miles away, literally out of nowhere. I mean, it literally came running. It just like almost appeared in the street again and was charging at us. I mean, we were beyond ourselves. We just didn't know what to think because it didn't make sense. There was not really any way that it could have got to where we got, you know, just running. And also, how would it even find us? We didn't even know where we were going or where we even were for that matter, because we were just driving around in Benedict Canyon.
Well, speaking of hounds, Claudia Cunningham is on the line as well. She's been very patient. I want to talk to her about her story in the book because Charles Fort, of course, the word Fortean comes from Charles Fort, the great researcher and author who really kind of set the stage for any of us who look into this stuff, whether it's written or it's podcast, wherever it is. He was kind of the original researcher who would kind of surface these weird occurrences in his research at the New York Library. But there's more weirdness that follows because apparently he lives in a haunted cemetery. Claudia, what's this about Charles Fort in a haunted cemetery?
Well, in 2010, after many years of interest in the paranormal, I think since the time I was a little girl and I used to tell scary stories to my friends who came over for pajama parties back in the early 50s. I was always interested in, I love to be scared. So that, I don't know what that means, but I was always kind of drawn to the unknown or kind of, I guess I was a born investigator. You know, what is it all about? Where do we go when we die? Why are we here? You know, what's the, what does life mean? So I started kind of early on, probably, I'd say maybe the early 60s when I really started to read everything I could get my hands on regarding the paranormal. But in 2010, I had a friend of mine who lived across from a cemetery in Menands, New York, which is about 3 miles outside of Albany, New York. Now, Albany is the capital of New York State, 160 miles north of Manhattan, halfway between New York and Montreal. And we live along the Hudson River Valley, which is a very rich and fertile area for the paranormal, as my studies have taken me. But my friend, I'll make it very brief. It's quite a long story, but she did call me one day, and she's a nurse at the local Albany Veterans Hospital, and she had an experience. She lived across the street, or I guess she still does. I haven't seen her in a few years. And she went into the cemetery one day after work to go on a historical tour. There are many famous people in the cemetery, including one of our U.S. presidents, Chester A. Arthur. And he's one of our lesser-known presidents, but he has a big grave there with a big angel that kind of watches over the grave. And it's a spooky place, I must say. And parts of it are very old. They go back to the Indian days and also the days of the aristocracy of the early settlers in Albany. They were Dutch. And so they have many beautiful crypts that align the roads that twist and turn throughout this old cemetery. A lot of people in the light of day, they take their dogs through there. They jog. They have picnics next to the pond. It's very beautiful, but there are some areas that have a certain feeling that maybe you shouldn't really go in there alone. And it was this area to which my friend decided to take a tour. And the day was a day when, I don't know if you're familiar with something called milkweed. It's, it's a white. Yeah, and it kind of was like all over the car that day, she said. She was the only one in the cemetery. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and covered her car. And she said, I had to put my windshield wipers on to keep, you know, keep it off the window screen. And she went up one of the side roads, which was gravel. It's all gravel roads there. So if there's somebody coming in front of you and back of you, you're pretty much going to be alerted to that. But the windows were down in her car. Everything was very quiet. And she got the feeling to pull over in this one area. And she was going to go out, you know, kind of study the pretty, some of the stuff is really beautiful. They're big angels and, like I said, crypts. And it's a throwback into another time. So she pulled over to the side of the road and switched her ignition off. And she was, you know, she looked in the mirror. There was no one behind her. And by the time she turned the car off and looked up into the mirror again, a big black SUV had appeared literally out of nowhere. She said it looked like a Hummer. It was completely black, no milkweed at all on it. It had kind of a, she said it kind of looked like it gave an energy off. It was, it was not right. Yeah, not right looking. It had big black tires, all completely black. Black tinted windows, and she thought that it might be somebody who was going to do her harm. You know, she wasn't thinking paranormal at that point. She said, oh, my heavens, you know, somebody's going to rob me or, you know, God forbid, rape me or whatever. So she put the car in forward and kind of crept away from this thing and watched the whole time in her mirror. And the thing backed up and did a kind of a semicircle turn. And she saw it go down one of the many roads in the cemetery. And she saw it, and she watched the top of the car till it disappeared. So she said, well, I'm going to follow it, because she got mad. She said, I have to find out who this is. She's a little bit nutty. I wouldn't have done that. But to her amazement, there was no road, no road where this thing went down, only a chain link fence with a bunch of graves on the other side. So in essence, the thing had vanished into thin air. So she turned around and went back down the way she came in. And there in the main road, which was the Macadam Road, was this thing sitting there waiting for her. And outside of the car, the SUV, was a man completely in black, a black, she called it a pork pie hat, which was like the hats of the old, think of the 1940s crime movies, like
yeah, and, hat. And more, yeah, and more recently, Walter White in Breaking Bad wore a pork pie hat. Very intimidating.
Okay, it was a pork pie, right? And the guy had wraparound black sunglasses, kind of a swarthy complexion, very skinny. I know she said it was kind of slim, completely in black. And she said the thing that struck me was it looked like his clothes just came out of the box, you know, out of Macy's or whatever, like they weren't worn, just like the car looked like it was brand new. And he kind of took his eyeglasses down and kind of looked at her very creepily over the top of his glasses. And she, you know, drove by him and she kind of punched it. You know, she hit the accelerator and she looked in the mirror. And within a second, both things blinked out, the man and the car. So that got me on my merry way as far as investigating all the virtual Disneyland of paranormal sightings in that cemetery. And since we're talking about cryptids, the one thing that sticks out in my mind is there is a black dog that appears out of nowhere, and it's always at dusk when the action starts, outside of the fact that Linda saw her vanishing man in black about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But there you might see a couple holding hands kind of drifting over the tombstones at dusk. A woman in black who kind of fades before your eyes, even a funeral procession from like the 1800s and with a cart drawn by horses, black horses going around the pond, everyone dressed in heavy black clothing, black veils. But this particular, and I call it a cryptid, I don't know if it was a ghost or what, but if you're in there at dusk and you're walking your dog at night, you have a good chance of seeing this thing. And it kind of keeps pace with the people as they're walking out, not in, but when they're leaving the cemetery. And it's probably at least 2 to 3 times bigger than a huge dog. And some people have reported saying that it has red eyes or a red cast to the eyes. What's really funny is, I'm sure you're aware of this, when you read about a person having some kind of a paranormal experience, whether it's a ghost or a UFO, and you have a dog or a cat in the house, they hide under the bed. They cower. They sense that there's something not right. But the dogs seem to be, you know, look kind of like right through this, and they don't react, which is kind of weird. And recently reported in the old cemetery's superintendent cottage, there is a dog, a horse that is seen at certain times of the month. And when I looked into it, it was in 1806, a horse had, it was hitched to a wagon in the nearby town of Watervliet, which is about a mile from the cemetery. It became spooked outside of a church, and it dragged the buggy up Broadway into the cemetery. The man jumped off. He was terrified, and the horse just kind of took off into a blind panic for some reason. It went into the cemetery, and it crashed into this superintendent's cottage, and it was killed. And it was, that was many years ago, but people have seen this horse. It's a black horse. Right. And recently, in a place called the McIntyre Plot, a lady was walking her Pomeranian when she felt someone gently touch the back of her head.
Oh, boy.
And she saw this strange horse, and she heard someone kind of singing very low in a low humming voice, and it just kind of vanished. It melted away in front of her. So that is the, outside of the horse and the cryptid sightings, that is, I can tell you a million stories that are going on in that cemetery.
What I was wondering was, now, do you think it's just a coincidence that Fort is there, or do you think the supernatural world somehow has decided, well, Fort is here, he's exposed all of these things, maybe we'll make this a special place? Do you think there's any connection, any possibility of that?
Well, I never even knew he was buried there until Tim came up one time and we shot some footage up there. In fact, I think I told him just before he came up, I can't believe it, Charles Fort is buried here. But since the sighting...
Well, his whole family's buried there.
His whole family. What is it, Tim? Nine graves or something like that?
I think nine tombstones, yeah. And a
it's
big,
a 40,
tall...
It's a Fortean cemetery.
It is. It's a Fortean cemetery. But I think since all these sightings have gone back into, 1700s, 1800s, no, this, I don't think Ford had anything to do with it, because he was
right,
around the Albany
you.
Area in the 1900s, early 1900s. So I think it's a coincidence that he's there.
Now,
I really do.
And I'm going to open this up to everybody, Michelle, Tim, Claudia, anybody can comment on this, or all of you can comment on it. Okay, so let's accept the premise for the sake of argument here that people are seeing devil dogs and dog men and Sasquatch and all of these weird things, and they are in fact interdimensional travelers. Are they coming here, in your view, intentionally, or are they kind of slipping through the cracks of the dimensions? I mean, what's the mechanism? What do you think's going on here?
Well, that of course is a $64,000 question. I would say maybe it's a little bit of both. Perhaps some of them are coming here, but then why would they be coming here exactly? I mean, they'd have to have a purpose and a rhyme or a reason behind it, and they don't really seem, unlike maybe UFO aliens or something like that, they don't really seem to have a plan of operation. Plus, they are very varied in nature. It's not like they all come from the same place, Yeah, I first found out about this, or got some inkling. John Keel was a good friend of mine, and he used to tell me about his wanderings around the country and all. And we thought he was a little bit, frankly, we thought he was a little bit just out there, because he was describing UFOs and a lot of other things that were going on and. What he called the window areas. Now, I went to investigate a case in the town of Athens, Ohio. I was actually out in Cincinnati on business, so I figured I would do a little road trip while I was at it. There had been a little item in the New York Post here in Manhattan, very unusual, that a young man, a teenager, had seen an object land in the cornfield behind his parents' home, and it had left some sort of markings in the ground. So I figured, well, this is what we would call a physical trace case. Let me get out there and see if I can interview the witness and see if there's any evidence where this thing landed. Well, it was probably about maybe a week or 10 days after the incident, and I was kind of surprised. When you think of cornfield, you think of 20 acres or 30 acres of corn. No, man, this was a little bit of a little patch behind the house, And so I'd never interviewed the teenager, but I talked to his grandfather, and he said, I think the boy was about 15 or 16 years old. He's very honest. He would never make this up. But you couldn't see anything. I mean, he offered to take me into the field to see where this thing had left some indention in the ground. But by that time, I think other people had trampled through it, and there wasn't too much going on. So I thanked him for his time and so forth, and said, keep in touch if anything else happens, because sometimes these things do manage to show up. We call them UFO repeaters. Anyway, I figured, let me canvass the neighborhood and see if anybody else witnessed this on this particular night in question where the sighting took place. Well, I knocked on a few screen doors, and at first most people were kind of hesitant to speak about it, but I found one or two women who were at home and doing their wash or watching TV or something, and so they would talk to me from behind this screen door.
Right.
Afraid to meet a ufologist face to face, I guess. Anyway, this one woman, I asked her if she had seen anything unusual. She said, well, not on that particular night, but she had often seen, oh, like a cylinder, a cigar-shaped object over the mountains or off in the distance, right? She said, but you know what's more unusual? And I said, no, what's more unusual? She said, Bigfoot is behind the house. I don't think she called him Bigfoot, but she described this like big hairy creature. And I said, well, how do you know that? She says, well, he's comes around to where the air conditioner is and pounds on the air conditioner. And maybe he's getting some water out of it or something like that. And she said, well, you know, where the water drips, the condensation all on the ground, you can see these very large, you know, footprints in the soil. So I thought to myself, well, this is very peculiar because we hadn't heard of too many cases. This was just right in the beginning where people were starting, the researchers were starting to connect the two, you know, mysteries. And so I went back there and, you know, it was a lot of mud and gravel and all. And I can't say that I really saw anything because I don't think he'd been there for a while. But she'd also reported, said that he had a very intolerable smell associated with him.
Oh, and this smell, yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah.
The smell seems to, you know, like follow them in a lot of these creatures or cryptoids, not just the Bigfoot, but it seems to, you know, follow them where sometimes it's a sulfur smell. Sometimes it's a very musky smell like that. Like they were living in a swamp or something. So maybe on their planet they are living in a swamp. I don't know. But they seem to go, come and go at their own discretion without the fear of anybody. And, you know, I guess attempts have been made to shoot at them. I remember one incident that I'll quickly relate. I was doing research. I probably wrote about the Skunk Man of the Everglades back in 1975 for one of the men's action magazines, Saga magazine, that used to carry a lot of these stories. And there was a professor, I think his name was Osborne, who had collected a lot of reports and had actually set up cameras on the perimeter of like an encampment where this thing was being seen in the Everglades. But there was one report, and I talked to the security guard who had actually thought that he had captured one of these skunk apes. Apparently, he was patrolling the ground of where he was working, where they parked some big trucks, you know, like 18-wheelers and stuff. And he saw this. They were albino, it seems to me. And he followed it, and he cornered it in the back of one of these 18-wheelers and slammed the door shut. And he could hear him inside, you know, trying to get out and cursing in his own language or something like that, you know. And so he called, you know, the police or other security guards or something. And at first, of course, they wouldn't believe what he had to say because whoever heard of capturing a skunk ape. But they got there and he said, well, it's in the back of the, you know, it's in the back of the truck here. I'll show you. You know, let's open the door and we'll see. Well, he opened the door and there was no skunk ape, but there was this ferocious odor. So where did the skunk ape go? It didn't walk through the walls of the truck, or you would have seen it. It didn't float up into the sky, unless it did it while it was invisible. So, I mean, there is enough evidence to indicate that these things are further out there than we give credit for.
Now, Michelle, with your Dogman sighting, you got the feeling this was malevolent. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I do.
So I'll open this.
I do believe it.
And so I'll open this question up to all of you. Do you think that these cryptid creatures, and let's say again, for sake of argument, they are interdimensional travelers of some type. Do you think they're solely malevolent? Are some benevolent, some neutral, or is it a mixture? What do you think?
I think it might be a mixture. I mean, I believe also, you know, like it seems like with Skinwalker Ranch, you know, it seems like, you know, from stories there, it sounds like things just came out from, you know, out kind of randomly, just out of nowhere, you know, tears in the, and literally, and just right there, you know, and the creature will step out. And then, you know, there's these stories, of people going missing, and you know, and there are some stories of like cryptid type creatures related to these people who've gone missing. And in some cases they'll be found later and, you know, they're dead, but they're in plain sight, you know, where people have searched, you know, search teams have searched over and over. So, I mean, to me, that seems kind of premeditated. So I do believe that they, you know, could be, you know, accidental visitors, but I also feel like there's some things that point to that they are, you know, somehow coming here and disappearing without a trace, but definitely with malevolent purposes.
Well, you know, there seems to be an increase in the sightings of these dog men. I had done a book a couple of years ago. You know, the Sir Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle, wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles, which is one of his most popular books. But what most people don't realize is that the story itself was based on a true incident that he had heard or read about, where this dog with fiery eyes was seen crossing the moors and frightening people. And this goes way back in England. I mean, but I've even interviewed people on my my show Exploring the Bizarre, you know, and apparently these reports of these dogman creatures go back hundreds of years, even in some of the villages that have since been abandoned, you know, in New England and all. They had similar reports and all of these ferocious creatures, which have been described as having the body of Arnold Schwarzenegger, I would guess 20 years ago or so, and you know, very muscular and fit, but the face of a ferocious pit bull. Now, some of the hunters apparently have been, in Pennsylvania have been confronted by them recently. In fact, I did an interview with the Butch Wachowski, who's actually contributed material. We interviewed him for the cryptid creatures from Dark Domains. And he told about how a number of hunters have, within the last year or two, actually been confronted by these creatures. Now, they haven't shot at them, thank goodness, although there's reports that they're planning to go back and, you know, get one of these things if they can. I dread the idea of doing that. But they said that they were never really actually attacked, but they felt like a feeling of dread overcame them when they were in the near proximity of these creatures. So there is something ominous about them. But then, Jim, I guess you would agree, because you've been the host of the paranormal show and all for many, many years, a lot of people are afraid of the unknown.
Absolutely. I think that there is, you know, again, I'm not going to be shaking hands with Sasquatch, but on the other hand, I think there is the idea that people do fear things that they don't understand, and it could be something innocuous. And it's because where we're talking about aliens or Bigfoot or whatever it might be. I do want to get in here before we close, and then I'm going to ask Tim where he can find this book and all the various books he does. But I want to talk to Claudia briefly about this Men in Black subject. This is one that fascinates me. Our friend, mutual friend, Nick Redfern has written books on this, Men in Black, Women in Black, done a lot of work in this area. What do you think's going on, Claudia, since you relayed that one experience?
Well, I actually had an experience 3 months after that. I became quite obsessed by what happened to my friend. And I was with my mother at a local shopping center, and I had my mother in the back seat and my dog in the front. And I pulled in front of a dollar store, and there was a big black SUV to the right of my car. And I said to my mother, "Oh, gee, maybe that's one of those guys." We kind of chuckled. And I no sooner said that than out of the back, not out of the actual vehicle, but like between that vehicle and mine, came this little guy, all dressed in black with the little hat on, just like, you know, the fedora hat, black sunglasses. He was very short, and he kind of stuck his head in the window and gave me a funny look. And I thought I would literally die. And my mother, I think she was, nothing really got to her because she was a tough old German. And she said, oh, my God, she said, that he didn't look right. And this guy stepped up in front of my car, and he kind of turned around and gave me a creepy look. And he looked like it was all in black, and he just kept on walking. So to me, like I mentioned to Tim, that was like an affirmation. I wanted a confirmation that what I had heard was actually true. And I think that thing, whatever it was, it didn't look right. It didn't fit. He did not look right. And I thought, my God, be careful what you wish for. But my feeling, it might be a little bit different than Tim or Michelle, but I believe it's demonic. I truly do. I believe these things can appear as a Bigfoot. They can appear as a UFO. They can appear as your Aunt Mary, who's been dead 20 years. They can shapeshift, if you want to use that popular term, into any type of anything that you believe in. If you believe in it strongly enough, you're going to see it. I don't think anything like this is to be played with. I hope I never see anything like it again. Will I continue always being amazed by the unknown? Always. I will always be an investigator at heart. I do want to know the secrets of the universe, but some things, I believe in the old biblical, what it says, the principalities and powers, the old good versus evil. This world is a testing ground. We are now, in my humble opinion, headed toward a supreme battle of good and evil. You see it every day, every time you pick up the newspaper. Never has been in the world a time like we're living through. And I believe that we're going to continue seeing things that amaze us in the sky, under your bed. anything is possible. And I think you have to get whatever your spirituality is, you better get right with that guy upstairs, because you're in for one wild ride. And that is my opinion, because God is my witness. I believe that.
Well, our show is about opinions, and so thank you for sharing that. Now, Timothy, we have a lot of things that you do, not just this book, but where can people find this book, and then where can they find the other cornucopia of paranormal offerings that you have?
Okay. Well, Cryptid Creatures from Dark Domains, of course, at Amazon.com. If you type in Timothy Green Beckley, you'll get a variety of books, and this one should be right up there. Or you can type in Inner Light, L-I-G-H-T, that's two word, dash Global Communications, and we have about 249 books. Or the simple thing is, you can go to our website, which is conspiracyjournal.com, and the first thing that appears is a little form that you give your email address, and I'll send you links to my YouTube channel, Mr. UFO's Secret Files. We have about 150 videos and audios and all, and I do the podcast on Thursday night. It's the Exploring the Bizarre with Tim Schwartz on KCOR Radio. So I'm active and I'm busy, and I'm always coming up with new ideas and new thoughts and spreading the word. And people always ask me, what is the word? And I say, damn if I know.
I think the more we learn sometimes, the less we know.
Yes, at least 50 years of confusion, but 50 years of provocative thinking. You know, some people play chess and some people play canasta. I'm not even sure what that is. But, you know, I enjoy it. But my thing is it's a thinking man's, subject.
It's a grand thought experiment.
It is indeed. And it is not for everybody. It does seem to be growing, thanks to people like you who have your media programs out there. How many shows are you doing now, Jim?
Well, we have the two main shows, Paranormal Podcast and Campfire, and then we have, seven other series. So I'm just trying to replicate what you're doing in books, I'm doing in a podcast,
yeah,
and in terms of just doing a ton. Just well, doing there
you,
time.
Where you go. Maybe someday we'll have a giant media corporation.
There you go. There you go.
There you go.
Well, I've loved this. We've had Michelle Lowe, Claudia Cunningham, and of course, Timothy Green Beckley. We've been talking about this book, which, you know, if you're into this sort of thing, I would highly recommend it. It's called Cryptid Creatures from Dark Domains, Dogmen, Devil Hounds, Phantom Canines, and Real Werewolves. Whew, got through that. Timothy, Michelle, Claudia, thank you all for being a part of the program tonight.
Thank you, sir.
You're more
thank
than
you so
welcome.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this supersized edition of the Paranormal Podcast. Great guests all around, fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank them one and all. I hope you're having a happy and healthy holiday season. And don't forget, if you're in the market for a great vacation for 2017, check out MysteriesCruise.com. That's MysteriesCruise.com for that special deal that we told you about at the beginning of the program. And I hope to see you there. Also, don't forget our friends over at Gaia. They're great. And also our friends at Wink. Check them out too. We thank you so much. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.